Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Too much struggle, stress, and strain can affect a boy's future. But how do we intervene in a positive, effective way? Stay tuned. This is the On Boys Parenting Podcast. We are your co-hosts, Jennifer L.W. Fink of buildingboys.net, and I'm Janet Allison of boysalive.com. Thanks for being here. Thanks for supporting our sponsors. How do experiences like physical abuse, racial discrimination, neglect, or food deprivation affect a child's ability to learn? More and more, we know that adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, have a profound impact on children. But how do we intervene to offer these children a more hopeful future? And how do we as teachers and parents counteract the harm that children have experienced? Our guest today, Dr. Mark Hauser, is a neurobiologist and educator, the founder of Risk Eraser, and author of a new book, Vulnerable Minds, The Harm of Trauma and the Hope of Resilience. It offers a hopeful new pathway to understanding children's trauma and providing effective interventions. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Great to have you. So each year, at least a billion, and I'm just trying to wrap my head around that number, but at least a billion children around the world are victims of adverse childhood experiences. And we know that kids exposed to ACEs are more likely to drop out of school, have a shorter life, abuse substances, and suffer from mental health and behavioral issues. And it feels really daunting to be able to do anything about it. Help us.
Yes, it does. And I think, you know, those numbers tend to numb us in many ways to the issue. It's very much like how I think, you know, most charitable organizations have really discovered that if you want people to help, you need to talk about Jane and Sue and Bill and John, the individuals. Mm-hmm. I can certainly remember being online, this is many, many years ago, and an advertisement popped up from World Vision saying, please help Darwin Nunez. And as a biologist, like, Darwin, really? and I was like, I'm all in.
Targeted marketing.
It was very, very well done. So I think it really is, you know, daunting to think about numbers like that. And, you know, I do work in parts of Africa, in particular Kenya. And, you know, there you hear numbers like 3 million orphans within the country, 54 million orphans in sub-Saharan Africa alone. And you think, well, you know, how can I possibly do anything? So for me as an individual, and I think certainly for every listener, we all have experiences either when we were children ourselves, or for those who work in school systems, working with individual students. I think what's really important, which certainly more and more, I think schools are becoming what's often called trauma-informed, that we need to have a greater awareness that adversity that children experience is not a rare event, but a relatively common event. And this is a good point, I think, in our conversation to just put a flag in the point that there's a difference between the experience and the response to the experience. Mm-hmm. And I want to make that point very clearly mm-hmm. and for us to work through it, because what many of your listeners may be aware of is the adverse childhood experiences studies. Those were studies about experience. They weren't studies about response to experience. And some people have very traumatic responses to experiences, and some people do not, mm-hmm. are much more resilient to the exact same experiences. So we want to really keep in mind that simply documenting the experience is not sufficient for us to do the work to potentially help with recovery because of differences in how people respond to adversity. That's an important piece.
One of the things that strikes me having this conversation, reading your book, which is out in March 2024, is that this whole idea of ACEs, adverse child experiences, and how they impact children's, humans, brains and bodies, and even their genetics that they pass on to their ancestors, is a relatively new field of study. I mean, the ACEs study came out in what, 2008 or 9?
1998 was the first one.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. So
my oldest son was born in 97. So it strikes me like this is just the life of my children, which means that for a lot of people, this is still relatively new information. And Janet, I'm thinking about you and I had on Kim John Payne. Mm-hmm. And Mark, I'm not sure if you're familiar with his work or not, but he talked about he had worked with, you know, children and children from war-torn countries and the kind of hyper-awareness and things he saw in them. And when he came back to the States, he was seeing some of these similar behaviors in kids that, you know, they didn't grow up in a war-torn or third world country. And that's when he started putting these pieces together. So it's easy for us to think these are things that happen to other people. But as you said, these kinds of adverse experiences are not uncommon, not even in 2024, not in the United States. Can you just, for those who aren't as familiar, talk about some of these more common experiences and how they affect people?
Yeah, that's good. I'm glad you kind of brought that back. I think there's an important piece of the history here. And I'll take it back to the actually inspiration for the adverse childhood experiences study. So Dr. Vincent Felitti was a preventive medicine doctor, he's still alive, in San Diego working for Kaiser Permanente. And at the time, he was working with a population of morbidly obese individuals. So these were individuals who were, you know, 300, 400, 500 pounds, who were really suffering from their weight issues, I mean, many, many ways. And he had developed a technique to radically bring their weight down over the course of about a year. And needless to say, because of that radical change in their physique, it was important to monitor all sorts of health issues.
Sure.
So he had one patient named Patty, and Patty had gone from approximately, you know, 430 pounds down to 150 or something like that within a year.
Jeez.
You know, radical change. And because of the monitoring, he noticed that after a few months, Patty began to regain some of the weight. And so he asked her, as he would, of course, ask any patient, is there anything going on that might explain this? And Patty said, well, you know, this is going to sound very strange, but I think I'm sleep eating. He says, well, what do you mean? She goes, well, you know, I live by myself. And when I wake up in the morning, there are pots and pans in the kitchen, and it's got to be me. I must be waking up in the middle of the night and cooking something and eating it and go back to bed and not even realizing that I'm doing that. He goes, well, that's certainly possible. Anything else? He said, well, yeah, I'm having kind of sexual relationships with an older man in my work. How do you feel about that? I don't feel so well. Why not? Because when I was a child, I was sexually abused by my grandfather. That was kind of, for him, a very striking piece of information. And it cued him into, as a doctor, he had never bothered to ask any of his patients about childhood, because these are all, of course, adults.
Sure.
So he went to a conference, and he, after having actually surveyed his entire clinic, and found that about 80% of these morbidly obese individuals had a history of sexual abuse, men and women. He presents this at a conference for doctors with eating disorder issues. So these were all professionals in the eating area. And effectively, the doctors laughed him off the stage. It's like, come on, these people are just making up excuses for their weight issues. You don't really believe that, do you? That night at dinner, a man from the CDC was sitting next to him and said, look, I don't know if you're right or wrong, but if you're right, we've got a real problem on our hands. But you need to find out more than just this population of people with obesity issues. You've got to ask a whole variety of people about their childhood. Thus was born the Adverse Childhood Experiences Survey that he did in collaboration with Robert Anda, a kind of a epidemiologist doctor. And they had sampled 17,000 individuals at Kaiser Permanente with this ACE score survey. In other words, 10 questions about different kinds of adversity that would happen from birth to the age of 18. That's how they define childhood. And they were adversities that occurred within the family environment. So emotional neglect, physical neglect, emotional abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, and then what they called kind of family dysfunction, things like mental health problems of a parent, incarceration of a parent, substance abuse, divorce, domestic violence.
And so already, listeners, I hope you take from that list, like a lot of you are going, oh yeah, me.
Yeah.
Me. Yeah. Also me. Yeah. Not unusual things. And what's so striking, for our purposes especially, that initial response of that group of doctors was kind of very representative of the thoughts of the time. It is the individual's fault. The individual should have this under control and is not controlling it. It is a willpower control issue. And the reason why I'm really highlighting that, because our audience is primarily parents and educators of boys. And this blaming of boys for their behavior, especially in classroom settings where this, you know, this happens, the outburst, the can't sit down, the hyperactivity, all these things, I'm not saying all of them are due to adverse childhood experiences, but a lot are. And there are a lot of people who still have not made this shift in their thinking.
Yeah, that's very good and well put. And I'm glad that that's kind of an interest for many of your listeners, because I think it shapes the hopefully the next part of the conversation will be, what can we do? And I think
Absolutely. Here
is where the lens of how we approach situations like this. So one is understanding the causes of potentially disruptive types of behaviors that may interfere with social relationships, performance in schools, and a whole variety of other things. And the second is how to respond to them. Mm-hmm. And the blame game often goes something like this: what's wrong with you?
Yes.
As opposed to what's happening to you, or why is this happening, such that you invite a conversation of collaboration to help. Mm-hmm. And that simple shift in mindset can be transformative for both the parent and educator and for the child, because you're not saying you've got something wrong. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the key insight that comes from thinking, to be honest, about any kind of quote unquote disability. So when I work with children, and I work with children who are have the full range of different kinds of disabilities identified, you know, clinically, motor, physical, sensory, cognitive, emotional, so forth. Some of them, it's because of a history of traumatic experiences and their responses, but some not. But if the approach is, what can we do to make this situation better for you and us? Then we have an opening for a collaboration, and also for not a self-indictment that right. I've got something wrong with me. Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to put that there, but we'll come back to it more specifically later. But that then led to, and you put it nicely, you know, think of yourself as going, okay, I probably had that experience. Yes, I did. Yeah. Da-da-da. So these are common things, but let's now put a little loop around those events. First of all, the survey itself is asking individuals who are adults to reflect back on childhood. Mm-hmm. Some of the adults in the original study may have been 60, 70-year-old individuals asking to recall about what happened when they were younger, before the age of 18. Mm-hmm. We know that those memories get fuzzier the earlier we move back in time. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's one piece to keep in mind. The second piece is that, of course, the adversities that were defined were specifically defined as within the family. And you mentioned your last guest who had experience working with individuals exposed to war. War wasn't part of the original ACEs survey, mm-hmm. nor was, you know, community violence, nor was discrimination and oppression, nor was poverty. So there are a whole suite of other things that over time have become layered into surveys like that. The other thing, which of course was not done at the time, and this is really important for your listeners, both parents and educators, is there was no sense of differentiation within the childhood period. So birth to 18 is equivalent, but we know from decades of studies that there are developmental windows where if certain experiences either don't happen or toxic experiences do happen, that you can completely derail core developmental systems of what it means to be a human being that flourishes.
The whole reason why we have the 0 to 3 programs, right? Birth to 5 programs, because those have been identified as such critical windows for development and intervention.
Absolutely. And so the ACEs survey just says within birth to 18, did anything happen? So the first point to make, and we'll, I'm sure, flesh this out a little more, is that it did not differentiate within that. Mm-hmm. It also never defined what really counts as an experience. So if my father went to jail for a couple of months, that counts as the same incarceration score as if my father was in jail for 5 years.
Because or my whole childhood.
Or my entire childhood.
Yeah.
Or was I neglected for a year when my parents didn't have enough money to make an income, but then they did and things got better. Mm-hmm. Yes, I was neglected, but there was no window of time. So that piece is really critical. We know from, again, like countless numbers of studies in non-human animals, in human animals, that the timing and tenure, how long it lasts, really matters for developmental processes to take place.
More to come on this important topic after these words from our sponsors. As Mother's Day is coming around, I find I'm missing my mom more and more. And there's always questions and stories I wish I had asked her when she was still here. I do remember that I gave her a book once upon a time with questions for her to write the answers to, and bless her heart, she didn't answer very many, so that was really a disappointment. But fast forward to now and technology, and now we have mylifeinabook.com. It takes all those questions and stories and it puts it in a format that is sent to your person, whoever you designate, on a regular basis, so that the prompts come, they're easily answered either written or voice to text, and they're captured by mylifeinabook.com. These family stories, this legacy that you want to leave for your children and your grandchildren. Mylifeinabook.com, create an unforgettable gift for your mom, your dad, your children, this Mother's Day. Use our coupon code ONBOYS for 10% off. Go to mylifeinabook.com and use ONBOYS for 10% off. Create that legacy. Carry on those stories.
We all know that vitamins can help fill nutritional gaps in our diet. But a lot of us don't like to take vitamins because we don't like swallowing pills. How do you feel about that, Janet?
There's some days that I look at my vitamins and go, yeah, I should take those. I'll do it later. But I'll tell you what's changed. I have gotten easy melt vitamins. I have the D3 and I have the B12s and a multivitamin. And I just pop them in my mouth and they dissolve and I don't have to think about swallowing a vitamin.
Yeah, and you don't necessarily need water either to have on hand to get this big vitamin now.
Yeah, no, and they taste good and they're sugar-free. They melt quickly. The reason they melt is because of plants, not chemicals.
Ah, plant-based nutrition. For a limited time only, you can receive a free 3-month supply of Easy Melt Vitamin D3 with your first purchase. To claim your free D3, visit try.easymelt.com/onboys. That's try, T-R-Y, easymelts, easymelts.com/onboys. You talk about the five T's in your book. You just mentioned two of them, the timing, the tenure. The others are type, toxicity, and turbulence. Do you want to just elaborate on that a little bit? Because it is critical.
Yeah, very good. So first of all, the original ACEs study and all the work on ACEs that have happened since then was fundamental to bringing a level of awareness to the adversities of experiences that children experience. So that is really important for everybody who listens today or who happens to read the book to be aware of that. Nothing that comes now is really in some ways a criticism of that awareness piece, that it's important
right.
for educators and parents and doctors and nurses and policymakers to be aware of the importance of adversity in childhood. But blurring over what the different types are, how long they last, which is what I call tenure. So type is one. Tenure is the length of it. Timing is when it occurred during development. Toxicity is the severity of it. And turbulence is a term I use for the unpredictability or uncontrollability of the adversity. And let me say a little about that, because that turns out to be one of the more fundamental of these dimensions. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the war example, which, of course, for many Americans, we think, well, war is a foreign concept. It doesn't happen on our soil. But I want to shape your listeners' thinking to think that what we are hearing about in Gaza, where half of the individuals who are suffering are children, to Ukraine, not on our soil, but the experiences are not necessarily unfamiliar. Exactly. And that is, these children have no control over their environment. Absolutely no control. In the same way that a child living here whose father comes home drunk and beats that child unpredictably mm-hmm. has no control over that environment either. Or a child who is homeless, who may be bouncing from couch to couch each night, has no control over that environment. And every listener will know that when things in our environment happen that leave us out of control, it totally tailspins for all of us, right? Mm-hmm. Like, oh my God, my parents are sick and I can't really help them because they live over here. Like, my father lives in France. So having control over what's going on, I don't have it.
Even as an adult, you're affected by that kind of helplessness and lack of control.
Exactly. So for the child, and this goes back to the fundamentals of early attachment, which I want to speak to. When a child early on has a strong attachment with mom and dad, or just mom, or just dad, depending how strong mm-hmm. go, one way to think of that attachment relationship is what is often referred to as a serve and return relationship. It's like a tennis match. Baby serves up a need, in synchrony, mom or dad, return that serve, okay? Mm-hmm. It's a tennis match, ping pong, back and forth. Now, that doesn't mean that every serve gets returned. When my three-year-old says, I need an iPhone, I'm like, sorry, dude, you're not getting an iPhone, right? So some serves are out of bounds.
Exactly.
And we say,
might
we
just
whiff
sorry, as a
right?
parent.
Right? Exactly. The synchrony, in some ways, is teaching the baby, developing baby, that needs are met. Mm-hmm. And they're met in a relatively timely fashion. When the baby who can't walk yet reaches his or her arms up, parents come and pick them up. Don't let them just sit there for eternity or ignore the request, right? Or when they cry of a certain kind, maybe because they need to be fed, mom nurses baby or gives the baby a bottle or whatever it is, right? So that synchrony and having needs met ultimately provides a secure attachment relationship. And that secure attachment relationship, not only for nutritional and personal needs, but it also allows the baby to feel safe. And we see in strongly attached babies that they're also more curious. They begin to explore the environment away from the parent, where weakly attached babies will not, or will do so less frequently. So at the root of much of what we see later on are those early attachment relationships, which are providing ultimately a safe environment for the baby to grow. So in the situation where a mom, and this is based on some actually extraordinary studies by a developmental neurobiologist in Israel, and sort of very sadly for me, and for you, both of you who read the book and those who will, the opening chapter of my book on war starts with a bomb that hit Gaza in 2021.
I know. I was so struck, Mark. I'm reading your book and you write and you're talking about Gaza. And I'm like, okay, when was this book written exactly?
It's very sad.
Yeah.
That's right. So there was extraordinary sadness in me. Gaza hits and I then go, wait, because, you know, you write a book, right? It's a long book. And you're like, wait, did I write something about Gaza? And it was the opening line, and it was. And so,
and you don't want it to be timely again for these reasons.
You
just
don't want it to be. No. And I think, you know, my lovely editors at Avery Penguin said, you know, sadly, you know, yes, we could rush this book to print earlier, but this is not going to lose its timeliness, sadly.
No.
So I think that, but the interesting thing about the work, and again, you know, everything we're discussing here, there's just this layer for me of sadness about the topic, which I'm sure for your listeners is true. And I just want to be cautious here that we're talking about such often excruciatingly sad situations for children who are living these things. And the children in Gaza and the Ukraine are those children. And so we have a situation, though, where because of the work of Ruth Feldman, we know that the exposure to war for these mothers has detrimentally impacted their empathy system. So their empathy is sufficiently compromised. And as a result of that, they often don't recognize or see the signals that their babies are emitting. And so you have a mom whose empathy has been basically buffered. So when baby cries, mom is not automatically putting herself in the baby's shoes and therefore is not responding. So that
this
attachment serve in return is kiboshed.
It is so heartbreaking because no mother wants to do that. No father wants to do that. Mm-hmm. You are talking about a parent who is themselves in this overwhelmingly turbulent situation. It is more than their brain can process. It is survival. And it's just heartbreakingly sad.
I think the key thing here is that we see, well, that's, of course, that's war. It's this extraordinary bombs going off, people dying, you know, torture. I mean, all these things that for many Americans are just completely unfamiliar as far as personal experience. However, here's where I want the listeners to appreciate that it doesn't have to be war. It can be any high-level stressful environment that mom is going through. And not only does it affect mom in response to when the baby's born, it actually happens during pregnancy. Mm-hmm. So the stress of pregnant mothers is affecting their stress physiology, which is directly impacting that child's development, so that even if the stress stops after the baby's born, that child has already been impacted, even if nothing else happens afterwards.
So think about, you know, not uncommonly here in the United States, listeners, women in domestic violence situations. We have a lot of families growing up in neighborhoods that are unsafe. There are neighborhoods where gunfire pops off randomly. Talk about turbulent. You know, extreme poverty, these are not unusual circumstances. And Mark, I want to ask you about, you mentioned how this, the stress affects the mother, which affects the child, you know, if pregnant mother affects the child. I've seen a multiple studies suggesting that males are more vulnerable to biological, psychological, social stressors than females. And I'm just wondering if anything, we know about how ACEs affect males compared to females. Is this an active area of research? Still, we need to know more.
Yeah, so it certainly is. And, you know, let me point to a study that is directly relevant to the one we just focused on. So just this last year, 2023, a study was published by a group that had followed mothers who were pregnant during Hurricane Sandy. This is a highly stressful, obviously, event. In terms of the length of it, of course, the hurricane itself didn't last months, right? So it's a constrained period of stress. And they are able to look at the impact on the babies who were in the womb during Hurricane Sandy 5 years later. Here's the upshot of this, and this is going to get right to your question about sex differences. Overall, the mental health of those five-year-olds was much, much higher than babies born before or kind of after, who were not kind of during the hurricane stress period, okay? So the stress to the mother had a direct impact on mental health of the child at five. Now, this is really important because for the educators who are listening today who think, what's wrong with you? Well, look, you know, my mom went through hell. And because of that, I'm suffering the consequences, right? Mm-hmm. I didn't do anything. You know, I'm not bad, right?
Yeah.
Okay. But big male-female differences. And these tend to show up quite frequently in many studies. Often, again, these are statistical ideas, right? Where there's clearly overlap. Boys tend to be more often externalizers. So in this case, oppositional defiance, ADHD. Girls tend to be more internalizers, depression and anxiety. And so those patterns tend to reoccur in different studies that have looked at different types of adversity and timing. You tend to get situations where the boys are externalizing. And of course, for educators, they're the ones getting suspended, right? You know, you suspend somebody for being, you know, down, right? And so that's why those data tend to show up like that more often, because of the externalizing piece of that.
And, you know, you're talking about Hurricane Sandy, this limited event, pandemic. Politics. I mean, talk about stress over a long period of time. And I, as a former educator, I just always think about special ed and who are the kids in special ed. And it's our boys that are in special ed far above our girls. And as you said, you know, it's our boys. Get him tested for ADHD. He can't sit still. And Jen and I have talked often about, like, there's the system, the educational system that needs to be worked. But that's where you're coming in and saying, hey, we've got to pay attention to all of these other things. And our boys are not bad. They are not wrong. There's all these other things going on.
Yeah. So you, there's two nice things that you said that I really want to pick up on. So one is the pandemic and what they did. And the second is kind of thinking about special education. I don't have the kind of the full data set lodged in my head, but I'll give you my own kind of personal experience in working in many, many, many schools. When I first started some 14 years ago working in schools of special ed, there was no question that there was a high ratio of boys to girls. We already know that for certain disabilities like autism, for example, that the ratio of boys to girls is already disproportionately high anyways. But it was true regardless of the disability in some ways. That has changed.
Interesting.
We see way more girls in the system in special education nowadays. Way more. And again, I couldn't quote you actual numbers at a country level, but my guess is that, globally, that's been the case. Now, of course, some countries don't necessarily have a special education designation.
And I just want to clarify, when you say way more, do you mean more girls in general compared to boys in special ed now? Or do you mean a hefty increase in girls, but not necessarily girls outnumbering boys in the special ed system?
The latter, just way more girls. So whereas I would say early on, maybe 15 years ago or so, maybe an 7-3 ratio of boys to girls, maybe now 6-4 or 5-5, even.
Okay.
So I think, if anything, it just says that ratio has gotten much leaner.
Interesting.
So you're seeing many more girls. And that may be in part a reflection of, at least in this country, much greater sensitivity to some of these internalizing factors that can really undermine what's going on in the educational system, right? A child who's shutting down is also not learning, as opposed to a child who's blowing up all the time is also not learning, but they're just different manifestations. So obviously a girl is as subjected to neglect as a boy is, and those things have dramatic impacts on development. So that's one.
And how does COVID play into all of these things that we're talking about? Coming up after these messages from our sponsors.
We talk at you all the time. Now we want to talk with you. Janet and I are partnering and we are so excited. We will be offering a 3-session series. Talk with Boys Like a Pro about anything and everything.
3 sessions, 3 weeks in a row. Jen, I'm so excited about this because not only do we get to see each other again in a week, but we get to talk directly with our listeners, and we'll be bringing great information, but also there will be time for discussion, time for questions. And that is truly where the gold is.
We will troubleshoot in real life all those questions that pop into your head when you hear us do podcasts and make suggestions. This is your chance to ask, to clarify, to really drill down into how you can use these communication techniques and shift your strategies in your home, in your family, with your child.
Go to boysalive.com/boys. And all the info is there. Get registered. This is going to be a whole lot of fun. Again, that's Talk with Boys Like a Pro about anything and everything. We will be live in May. All the details are at boysalive.com/boys. And get registered. Don't delay. This is going to be so much fun. And it's going to give you peace of mind, new information, new insights. We hope you'll join us.
COVID's a really, really important thing to remark on here because of, again, this developmental window. Mm-hmm. For parents listening today and for educators listening today who are working with teens, kind of middle school and up, we now know very well that that period of time is a critical period for social interactions. Mm-hmm. They need social interactions the way a baby needs milk. Mm-hmm. And that may sound hyperbolic on my part, but it's not. It really is a critical period. And what did COVID do? It effectively deprived the world's teenagers of what they need. Mm-hmm. And we are now seeing in the school systems the consequences of that. We have remarkably developmentally immature kids who just don't have the right social skills to thrive in a school or any other kind of environment.
This is a perfect time to talk about what do we do about this? Because I think what we have all seen, what you are saying, when we just hear it, it makes perfect sense. The social interactions, teens need that like babies need milk. So essentially, we've deprived babies of milk for 2 to 3 years, and then we throw them in the school system and we're like, and achieve just like you would have if we'd been feeding you for 3 years. And then we go, well, what's wrong? And I hear blame for kids. I hear blame for parents. I hear blame for teachers, Mark. So what we're doing isn't working. What is a better approach? We can use COVID and the pandemic as our starting point, but really it's this, how do we mitigate and build up kids who have experienced these adverse experiences? Yeah.
So many listeners will know and be personally experiencing, certainly educators, that certainly in many schools in the United States, but it's certainly something that's growing in other countries as well, is there's a focus on what are often called the soft skills, teaching social emotional learning. I get why they're often called soft skills, but The executive system, which is often involved in many of these social interactions, and what I mean by that are things like self-regulation, planning, working memory, attention, those are all cognitive capacities that are critical to our social navigation. And if we're not attending to the social cues that are relevant to the situation, we're not going to interact in the right kind of way. If we don't have the ability to regulate emotions so that they're not overwhelming us, we're also not going to be attending necessarily to the right situation. We're not going to be taking other people's perspective ever. We're going to perseverate with what we want to do. We're not going to plan for how to achieve our social goals. And those are all parts of the executive system that link to social processes, but they're critical to them. So what we're seeing are children who often don't read the tea leaves. Even if they read the tea leaves, they don't seem to care about the consequences.
Right.
And so they are leading to situations that are dysfunctional for them. So what is often being done in schools now, and these are some of the important things, is it's being tackled, I think, from different directions. And let me just give some concrete ideas. On the one hand, are strategies to better cope with hot emotions. So breathing techniques, pausing before you answer, considering alternative perspectives, right? So you're giving kids strategies for handling different situations. A second approach, and this is a little more concrete, but this is one that I find to be a very useful thing for parents who have children who may be difficult and the parents themselves. So it's what's often called in schools, the size of the problem and the size of the reaction. And here's a little simple kind of metaphor and analogy that you can use, and you can do it, I recommend, visually. Create three different size boxes, small, medium, and large. And now you say, and it's great when parents can do this with their children, let's imagine a really big problem, something that would make us so, so sad and stressed and bothered. So, you know, I often say, like, if my father was really, really sick, well, let's say cancer, I'd be so upset. Like, you know, he's my father, right? And that would go in the big box. Now let's imagine a little problem. You know, I'm about to go play tennis and I stub my toe. God damn it. Little problem, right? It's not going to ruin my life. Okay. And then I give something in the middle. You know, I'm about to get on a podcast and there's a traffic jam and I can't get to my computer and I'm really frustrated. But, you know, look, if we have to reorganize it, big deal. You know,
right.
It's manageable. Okay.
Yep.
So we have those problems. Now you do that when you're in a calm state.
Yeah. That's so important.
Out,
yeah. Right?
And now you have anchors. And now you are also talking about the kind of the size of the reaction that would be appropriate for what's in those boxes. So that then when a problem arises and the child has this supersized reaction, you're like, wait, wouldn't that be in the middle box? But your reaction seems to be one that's like the big box. So you're bringing greater awareness with a little visual that child, him or herself, has defined for you when they're in a calm state. And that begins a process of effectively gaining greater body awareness of what's going on. Because for many of these children, and for certainly certain types of traumatic experiences, there's very poor somatic body awareness. They don't get the cues of my heart's going, my fists are clenched, my legs are jittering, right? They're unaware that that's happening. So bringing greater awareness to that can ultimately help them work with those systems to gain greater control over them.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, please go ahead. Yeah.
You know, the small, medium, large problem and reaction. I love that. I see a lot of helpfulness in that. And I see a need for awareness that to a child, what seems big may not be what seems big to us as an adult. So, like, I'm with you. Yes, a parent across the sea with cancer, incredibly stressful. if I ask a five-year-old what's going to be a big problem, depending on the day, I mean, it could be my favorite dump truck getting broken. And I guess I'm looking for a little nuance, you know, like helping the child put perspective on problems without invalidating their feelings about what's important.
So that's a terrific question for not only the specific example, but for the entire conversation. One of the things I point out in the book is the Adverse Childhood Experiences Survey is culturally insensitive. What counts as neglect for you, not getting an iPhone, is not what a child in the Sudan's talking about when they don't have their next meal. Right.
Yes.
So there's got to be cultural sensitivity here as well. Okay, perfect. So that's equally true for a child. It's important to validate, like, yes, if your favorite blanket is ripped apart because you've used it so much and we need a new one, but it won't be the same blanket, right?
Yeah.
Fair enough. That is pretty significant for that child. That's fine if the child puts that in the big one, but you also want to then help them understand. So would losing your blanket for you be the same big problem as mom is really sick?
Yes.
You want to help them understand that there's a spectrum here. They may put everything into the big one.
So you're contextualizing and you're in doing this in conversation, in conversation. Relationship.
That's right. And as they get older and have different experiences, what goes in the box is going to change too. So you revisit the boxes, right? My girlfriend just dumped me. I mean, there's nothing worse than that, right? Okay. So for a teenager, that's just going to trump everything. Right. That's fine. But let's continue to work on where are we in this scale from little to big.
I like
to
that.
Help them grow. It's very important because, again, you know, for the readers who read it and you guys read it. But, you know, I also point to the fact that, for example, things like physical abuse, there are 19 states within our country that allow for corporal punishment. So what a child in one of those states thinks of as my teacher slapped me, I'm like, well, that's just the norm. I don't think of that as physical abuse. And yet that's something you're going to check off on the box. And so it's important to keep in mind for every educator in the United States, you don't just have students who are born in the United States. We have an immigrant population.
Yeah.
We know that. We have to deal with that when we think about cultural differences, how they're interpreting certain kinds of actions, including suggestions for building resilience.
The more I learn about ACEs, and we have these conversations and we talk about how they can impact people, I cannot help but look around our country, look around our world and go, you know, part of what's going on here is that we have a whole lot of adults who are dealing with a whole lot of stuff that they haven't really dealt with yet. We've got adults who are lashing out big over things that aren't that big disproportionately. So that we adults, Janet, you and I have said it all the time, like listeners, as an adult, I always think step number one, it can often be the hardest, but deal with your own stuff because you need to deal with your stuff to most effectively be able to help the children around you. If you are having outsized reactions to things, and I am including myself in this easily describes the first 10 years of my parenting until I started dealing with some of my stuff. It's hard, but that's a first step for many of us. And I think we need to really express some of the hope here, Mark, because as we've talked about, adverse experiences, adversity are not uncommon. So much is uncontrollable. I can be a very loving, caring parent, and I can't stop war. I may not have the resources to move to a different neighborhood or to feed my child as much as I want to. Let's talk about the hope here.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the kind of comments I make in the book is that it's highly unlikely that as a species, we are ever going to get rid of adverse child experiences. That sounds, you know, monumentally depressing, like a wet blanket. But I say that because I think we need to be honest. And with that kind of honesty comes, I think, the hopeful piece, which is as a result of that, we need to build children as resiliently as we can from the get-go, not making any assumptions about what they may or may not experience as they get older. Because if we can build the resilience, we have a better chance of helping people make it through what they may confront later in life. We need to take into consideration that for all these studies that we've talked about in terms of adverse childhood experiences, there are massive individual differences in how people respond. And so the kind of the visual I want to have your listeners keep in mind is, let's imagine a spectrum or a scale that goes from highly vulnerable to adverse childhood experiences on one end, left, traumatic responses, to highly resilient on the other. That scale is composed of both nature and nurture, of both biology and the environment. And you can start on one part of the scale and you can shift towards the other and vice versa. So it's a sliding scale. So ultimately, we want to be shifting people towards that resilient end on the right. What we've learned from countless studies is that even with the same level of adverse childhood experiences, some show no traumatic responses. Why? And the answer to that question, in brief, is in part biology. There are parts of the developmental biological program that is providing them with, in some ways, greater immunity to subsequent adversity, and certain aspects of the environment that is buttressing that immunity. And, you know, I use an example, my father, who's now 92, who was a child living through Nazi-occupied France and was often separated from his parents for about 4 years on and off for that period. And he is the most resilient, you know, dude I know. And so he suffered as a child. And yet he had, despite everyone in his family dying in the result of this Holocaust, except for his parents were incredibly loving. And for those of you who've seen the beautiful movie Life is Beautiful, where the father creates an imaginary world for his child during the war, his parents didn't necessarily do that, but they constantly were there as support systems. Yes. And so I think the key is we think of what's happening in the home environment, in the school environment, to support children, girls who are shut down, or anyone who's shut down and maybe isolated. How are we going to help them create those social relationships? Because social relationships are going to help to buttress that child when they're having difficulty. For the child who is responding big to the relatively small problems, having an oversized reaction, because a child has been abused or confronting domestic violence or war, has a system of the brain that's on high alert all the time. How are we giving them coping skills to manage their emotions when things get difficult? So it's building in those systems, both community, family, teachers, trust and relationships. For everybody who's a teacher and who's worked in special education with children with trauma, because there's been no consistency or predictability, giving them choices, being consistent and predictable is the art of getting back into the game. And so we need to take the strategies that we're using for children who we know have had traumatic experiences and building those into the curriculum for all.
Yes.
In anticipation of what may happen. And if it doesn't, great. Who cares?
Fantastic.
Yeah.
You win.
Listeners, I as we were talking, Janet saw me, Mark saw me because we're on video. I stepped aside for a second because this conversation is reminding me of our previous conversation, Janet, with Stephanie Malia Kraus, a woman who wrote a book out last year, 2023, Whole Child, Whole Life, 10 Ways to Help Kids Live, Learn, and Thrive. And it's for parents and educators. And it's really about, how do we build up these supports? How do we add in supports that will buttress children, not if, but when they face adversity? This world is a challenging world. Mark, you're right. We're never going to eliminate challenge. And there'd be all kinds of problems if we did, as much as we think we would love that. It's about building up our kids, building support, being in community with one another. We are a social species. Together, we can get through things. And that's what we need collectively to support our children.
And it's all about connection. We talk about it all the time. If we can just filter everything we do through that way of being connected, through that, you know, the boy who's having a meltdown on the floor in the middle of third grade, it's not about what's wrong with you. It's about, hey, I'm here as an adult with a big heart, and I'm going to help you. Yes. And so keeping that connection is just primary. And Mark, you have given us, I'm kind of getting chills because you've given us some really practical strategies today, but the work that you are doing in schools and in the world is, I'm getting seriously choked up here. It's just so profound to be able to recognize these experiences that we all have. And it is a scale, like you said, it's absolutely a scale. Your book is Vulnerable Minds, The Harm of Trauma and the Hope of Resilience. Where can our listeners connect with you, learn more about the work you're doing with Risk Eraser, which we haven't even talked about, maybe say a little bit about that, but where can our parents and teachers connect with you?
Yeah, I think the best place is my my author website, which is just Mark D. Hauser. So Mark with a C, French father, D as in dog, and then Hauser, Hauser.com.
Thank you for your work. Thank you for all you're doing to help all of our children. You know, most of us, we're biased. We care the most about the children in our homes and in our communities. But what happens to children all around the world affects all of us. Let's build them up. Let's support them. Let's love them all. Thank you, Mark.
Agreed. Thank you both very much for this conversation. It's wonderful.
We hope this episode has been valuable to you, has given you some new insights. Maybe you want to share it with an educator or a school administrator. This is the On Boys Parenting Podcast. We are your co-hosts, Jennifer L.W. Fink of buildingboys.net. And I'm Janet Allison of boysalive.com. Thank you for being here. Thanks for supporting our sponsors.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.